Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to the 467th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You get your daily reading from me and other writers over at Once a Metro and the rest of the SB Nation family of soccer websites. Chat room is open. Come on in. Discuss amongst yourselves if you like. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer it to the best of my ability. And as we continue on talking about the 25th anniversary of Major League Soccer, once again, it's not just the players. It's not just certain aspects of the league. It's also the voices of the league as well. So it's going to be a fun time tonight as I do these little fun information things. And as we get ready to talk about these great voices that cover Major League Soccer and in their individual clubs. And it's going to be a lot of fun, obviously, as we are trying to get the guest on tonight. And that guest is the one and only man that not only a great voice for the game of soccer in the United States, but in my opinion, as always, I know he'll probably be like, oh, gosh, shucks, don't have to go there, but I will. I feel he deserves to be in the Soccer Hall of Fame in the media wing. The one and only, the play-by-play voice of DC United, Mr. Dave Johnson, joins me tonight. Dave, good evening. I hope you and your family are safe throughout this entire coronavirus pandemic, and I hope all is well with you in our nation's capital.
Well, I like that intro. You can keep talking if you like, but no, in all seriousness, no, doing well, and look, we just have to, you know, all try to keep uplifting each other and trying to stay positive. And that sounds cliche to say, but I you know, this whole period of time has been, I think, a sort of a mental challenge for a number of people for a variety of reasons, because mm-hmm. we've never been through something like this. And you know, I think of, as I've been talking to many younger people as well, you know, I'm concerned about the younger generation, the people that were expecting to, or did graduate from high school, but graduated under different circumstances this year. The same thing for college, or, you know, there's stress involved with that kind of transition anyway. And I think we're all feeling stress. So I think the important thing is, mm-hmm. is that that's why it's great to be talking with you tonight, is to stay talking with each other. Nobody's got any quick answers. If you're looking for quick answers or quick solutions, we're not going to have any of that, because they just don't exist. Or at least if I, you know, if they did, I don't think we'd be feeling this kind of stress. But that's why it is important to just stay connected. And I always tell people, you know, call some friends you haven't heard from in a while. Just see how they're doing, because we all do it. We all do it. When somebody says, "How you doing?" you right away say, "Oh, I'm doing all right. I'm doing fine." But you might not be. So it's good to stay connected to each other.
So I have to ask you, your career calling DC United games has been the same amount as the league has been around for these first quarter of a century, 25 years as the play-by-play voice of DC United. How remarkable has it been? And are you still shocked that you're still calling these games throughout your entire broadcasting career?
Well, I mean, yes, because I grew up as a child of the NASL, and then I grew up during a period of time, and I actually got to do the Baltimore Blast the final couple of years of the Major Indoor Soccer League, when we thought the Major Indoor Soccer League, the original one, was going to be the next major sport. In fact, the great American sports writer Frank DeFord said it'll be, right behind basketball, baseball, football, and basketball as the fourth major sport. And he mentioned that it was made for television, and it was, this big orange ball, and there was high scoring and lots of excitement. And, as I've talked to many people, actually it's come up recently in conversation, the Major Indoor Soccer League with the Cleveland Forces and the Baltimore Blast, I mean, they were selling out arenas. You couldn't get a ticket. Unfortunately, they had some other problems and they never were able to truly probably achieve their potential. But I certainly never expected after that folded that I couldn't, even with getting the World Cup in 1994, I couldn't envision, what we're experiencing now. And so, but that's why I say to get to this point, and you see it in the team names, the Seattle Sounders, the Portland Timbers, the Vancouver, whatever. This was not an overnight success story. There's roots in so many of these cities, including near where I'm talking right now, Washington, D.C., that go back to the 70s that parents and grandparents now or whatever, they know about soccer because it was not like it was in the 70s where kids like I was dragged your parents to one game or two games, but they didn't necessarily become season ticket holders because they didn't know what they were watching. So it's been a journey that's I think about my time with the Maryland Bays and the American Professional Soccer League, and there was so much leading up to just the start of Major League Soccer, even doubts that Major League Soccer would even get started, because, and keep in mind, the World Cup was in 94. The part of us getting the World Cup was the promise that we would establish a first-class, top division league after the World Cup. Well, after the World Cup meant 1995. Well, 1995 came and there was no Major League Soccer. And I think people think it now that it was just a guarantee that it was going to happen. But no, they just barely, maybe that's too strong to characterize as barely put it together, but they needed extra time to put it together and finally launched in 1996. And as I continue with this incredibly long answer to one question, that we're now in the successful period we are, is a bit, a wonderful thing to try to wrap your head around, because, I remember that period after 2000 and 2001 where you thought, I don't know if we're going to make it.
No, I mean, the contraction of both Tampa Bay and Miami at the time was very, very difficult because, great strides were made to bring in Chicago. And, of course, at the time, the Miami Fusion. And then, of course, when the contraction came, Miami came and went. And the Tampa Bay Mutiny came and went. And we went back from 12 down to 10 again. So, there was a lot of question marks there. But, obviously, it has prolonged and progressed. And look at where we are now with so many teams in this league. It's just been unbelievable. Just to go and talk about, all these games you've called locally, whether it be, I guess, Hometown Sports, Comcast Sportsnet, DC, and of course, there was always the Flow Sports then and like last year, and maybe a few other local DC broad channels that are broadcasting these games. Which ones did you enjoy watching, or which ones should I say did you enjoy broadcasting? Because we all know about, the Jaime Moreno, Marco Echeverri, Raul Diaz Arce era, how that sprungboard everything that was those early championship years with DC United. Of course, let's not forget, of course, Jeff Agus, John Harkes, and so many other players that, made that era, you would have to say, the first early dynasty of Major League Soccer.
Well, yeah. I mean, and also let's back up a point to what we were discussing, why we're even here today. Let's put a fine point on that. We are not having this discussion if it was not for Phil Anschutz specifically, and then Lamar Hunt, who well, not just specifically Phil Anschutz, but Phil Anschutz, Lamar Hunt, and Robert Kraft. If they didn't stay involved after 2001, it's done. It's over. So that's something that also that, you know, that's why I'm so proud that happy that Lamar Hunt, the U.S. Open Cup is named after Lamar Hunt, because he started believing in soccer in 1967 when he invested in the original North American Soccer League, the Dallas Tornado. And, you know, that's how close it was. We don't have getting to the point where the Torontos, et cetera, that you know, we're going to have a league unless they step in and keep it going. People forget for a while, Anschutz owned DC United, because after that 2001 period, I can't even count the number of franchises Anschutz took on because investors and owners
yep.
had dropped out. And I'm not being critical of those investors and owners. I'm just saying it was a difficult time in our country in so many ways. It was post 9/11. So, you know, the story of soccer there is you had to have faith of certain people to keep it going. So getting back to your point, look, if I did the Maryland Bays and I did the A-League and so many other leagues, so then I'm on this journey with Major League Soccer, and we're playing in big stadiums, we're getting big crowds, and then we're having this wonderful romance in D.C. right from the beginning because of the way D.C., you know, worked to establish a franchise, not only on the field, but off the field, and their tremendous involvement in the community. So then you've got this wonderful synchronicity where you've got what's going on the field, but also what the Marco Etcheverrys and the Jaime Morenos and so many others and the John Harks, how they're Tony Santa, how they're identifying with the fans within the community as well. And so, you know, beginning with that 96 year, it was a magical ride that through all the ups and downs, through all whatever, you know, question mark we had about, you know, the future of the league or that type of thing, the passion and connection with the supporters has always been there. So those teams, you know, set the way on the field. But, you know, what's really been the amazing story of DC United is the supporters set the standard in that first year. In the first year, you know, DC was the place that the networks wanted to come because it was the place you could count on the authentic, true atmosphere, and RFK just rocked. And those fans didn't walk away after 1999 and after another MLS Cup, and then all of a sudden you're struggling and there's some lean years. They stayed supportive. So it's been a great journey with you know, so many great teams and great periods. You know, obviously the initial period of the way mm-hmm. the franchise was established, making, you know, you can't help but, you know, have fond feelings of a situation where you're going to four championship games in 4 years. You know, that's special by any measure. And then. But still, you know, to win again in 2004 and to show that you could rebuild and regroup and be again on top of MLS, that was part of the maturity of the league. So we've had a lot of fun in DC.
So when you saw during game pro in both halves, of course, we all remember the shootout clock and not your typical penalty kick shootouts, but a running shootout. When you first heard about this, what was your opinion about it? Was it, oh, this is something new that I don't mind giving it a chance, or did you really think this was going to be a waste of time?
Well, no, the shootout was just borrowed from the old North American Soccer League. So I actually, you know, grew up it was not a surprise to me whether I liked it or didn't like it or whatever again, keep in mind that even in 1996, you still had, you know, the large portions of media doubting and against the sport, and it's not going to work and it's too low scoring and, you know, we can't have ties and that type of thing. So, you know, it didn't surprise me that you had to go through a period that, all right, we introduce this and see how it goes, and see, also take the temperature of where, you know, the soccer culture is in this country, to whether it is going to, is it going to accept a tie? Is it going to, you know, work this time? I mean, again, it's easy, you know, now in hindsight, you know, where we are now as a league with 25 years on and you know, and the climate in the world where, you know, people are also fans of so many worldwide teams and that type of thing. When this league was established, it was established after the previous one, which had some of the best talent ever assembled in one league. It had gone out of business in 1984. If you go back and look at the original NASL and look at the names, the Johan Cruyff, mm-hmm. the Eusebio, you'd go right down the list of Hugo Sanchez. I mean, you can pick a continent, a country, and they played in the NASL, and it didn't work. So there was real concern that, okay, we've got to find a way not only to appeal to the soccer purist, if you will, or whatever, but also, you know, expand that audience. And so I think, you know, look, it's been proven out the way the league was set up with a single entity to give it a chance, training wheels, if you will, to you know, if the league was not a single entity, it would not have survived, because you needed the collective to push the league through the early years. And so you try things like a shootout clock or you know, the shootout, you know, and I'm glad it's now, you know, we accept the game for what it is. But I also think that, you know, and it's been proven out that, and we see this with other sports. I mean, soccer. Now, I'm not a big fan of the way VAR in general worldwide is being applied. I think it's almost too much. I would have been happy with just goal line technology. Just, you know, if it really did cross the line of don't take away a goal, because goals are so precious. But sometimes, you know, where we're dissecting offsides by a millimeter, that drives me bananas, and I don't think that works. But, you know, one of the rules from the original NASL that I wish they did experiment, they got FIFA's permission, but FIFA took it away and said you can't do that anymore, is the 35-yard offside line. In other words, you are not offside until within 35 yards of the goal. And I think that's a rule that was working in the old NASL, and I wish it was applied today. So, you know, you can't be afraid to be innovative. And I think a perfect example of that is, you know, once upon a time, you know, baseball was by far America's pastime. And you could argue that it didn't change with the times like football did, American football. And look at now, you know, 40 years ago, baseball was king. Now it's NFL football.
No, absolutely. And now we got an opportunity, I think, with this whole situation with the coronavirus and baseball looking very bleak, that they're not going to restart, that who knows, maybe the attention will now be drawn to Major League Soccer a lot more than maybe normal. So we'll have to wait and see on that. When you have interviews with these players, the coaches for DC United, when you got started, and it was, of course, Bruce Arena who was the first head coach of DC United, what struck you about him? Obviously, you probably knew him as head coach of Virginia University of the men's soccer program, but now he's running – excuse me. I'm sorry about that. Now he's running and leading men instead of college players. What did you think about Bruce Arena starting off as the head coach of DC United?
Well, I've always believed that it didn't matter what sport Bruce was coaching, he'd find a way to have success. You know, as you mentioned, I knew Bruce very well from broadcasting college games at the University of Virginia. And also, we had a weekly soccer show that we started in 1992 on Home Team Sports on television. And Bruce, again, thinking out, you know, beyond just you know, obviously he's focused on Virginia and his team and et cetera, but I think about how the kind of support, you know, he would come up from Charlottesville to be on the show, and obviously it did him some good to have that kind of exposure. But having said that, you know, Virginia was already a very much established program, and so it's not like he needed us. It was more we needed him to come up and support the show and be involved. And he was smart enough to understand that yeah, you have to get it right on the field, but you also have to market the sport. And you know, you look at 1992, they built a soccer-specific stadium, Clocker Stadium at the University of Virginia. That's 1992. I mean, that was unheard of at that time. So it shows the kind of the way he thought and the way he worked to promote his program and to deal with his players. And, you know, I can still remember after his introductory mm-hmm. press conference at DC United, he comes over to me and says, we're gonna do a weekly show. And it was his way of saying, you know, we're going to do something here to get people interested in DC United. We're, you know, again, this is 1996. There's not been a pro soccer league of significance in this country for a while. It wasn't just going to turn on the switch and people stampede and there you go. So, and then, you know, I had no doubts about his ability to manage a team, to how he deals with players. And, you know, I didn't have doubts then. And certainly you look at his resume now, you know, whether he's dealt with the Marco Echeverrys, the Jaime Reynos, or David Beckham with the LA Galaxy. And I just happened to watch the Beckham experiment, that movie last week again. And, you know, the respect that David Beckham has for mm-hmm. Bruce Arena and the difference it made for Beckham having Bruce Arena at the LA Galaxy. So, but, you know, again, I think if you told Bruce to run a basketball team, because he's smart, he'd figure out a way. You know, he did with DC, and he did with the U.S. national team as well.
So I have to ask you this question. Of course, we all know the big rivalry in Major League Soccer, Metro Stars / New York Red Bulls, DC United. Before that first blow-up happened at RFK, were you thinking, well, you know, somewhere, somehow, there has to be a rivalry. Somewhere, somehow, we got to have something sparking right away. We all know about Liverpool versus Everton, Inter Milan versus AC Milan, Arsenal versus Tottenham, Manchester City versus Manchester United, Barcelona versus Real Madrid. Obviously, it's not at that level, but still, though, here, DC United or somebody needs to really spark something. Something has to have a go. Somebody needs to start some really bad blood between either against Dallas or against Tampa Bay or against New England. Did you think it would have been New York, New Jersey against DC?
No, I mean, you know, I think, you know, as the league is starting, and you're just excited that the mm-hmm. league is starting and games are played, and there's some, you know, you're wowed by the crowds we were, you know, getting, because I still remember that first inaugural game in San Jose, and obviously that was sold out, and I remember reporters asking at the time Commissioner Doug Logan what he was hoping for in other games, and he was saying hoping for five figures, meaning at least 10,000. And you know, I remember some reporters saying, "Well, you're lowballing it, whatever," and they kind of scoffed at him, and I just kind of shook my head. I thought, you just have no idea. I mean, with the Maryland Bays, we played attractive soccer. We advertised like you would not believe, and if we got 1,000 people on a beautiful day, we were doing hula hoops or jumping jacks or whatever I'm trying to say. So, in other words, as that first year has started, you're just kind of waiting to see what develops. You're not thinking something's going to develop with New York or something's going to develop with Columbus and or whoever. And it, you know, but it's like, you know, it happens. It naturally happens in every sport. be based on a playoff series, based on something. You know, certain teams start to become rivals, and typically it's because also then that rivalry is stoked if they play, you know, several times a year. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's harder for, you know, D.C. to be, even though D.C. was playing the L.A. Galaxy in those years, always in the championship game, it's hard to think of them as your arch rivals. So, you know, in the early years, it because of, you know, circumstances happened on the field, played a number of times, it just developed into a great rivalry.
I have to ask you this. How many analysts have you had that you've been working with you? And at the same time, which ones have been the best? I know you've had Thomas Rongen as your analyst for DC United games. You've had Santino Quaranta, the former player for DC United, as your analyst for some of these games. How many have you worked with in total locally, and which ones were your favorites?
Well, I mean, first of all, I've been amazingly blessed. The quality of the people I've worked with is just been tremendous, and right out of the gate. My first broadcast partner, one of the finest men I will ever know, and one of the finest gentlemen I will ever know, and a person, again, if truth be told, we're not having this conversation if it wasn't for Gordon Bradley. He is a Hall of Famer, and he deserves to be a Hall of Famer. He helped, along with Clive Toy, bring Pele to this country. Other than that, he didn't do much. So, in other words, if he's not around and didn't have the perseverance to stay here and try to make something happen, we're not having this conversation. And you have to think about the backdrop of what Gordon Bradley was dealing with. Is the NASL was down to five teams in 1969. They're running the league out of the basement of Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. They established a team in New York, the Cosmos, on Long Island, and Clive Toy starts a four-year odyssey to get Pele, knowing that if they're ever going to have a chance to make it in this country, there's going to have to be a big bang, if, for lack of a better way of describing it. So my first partner was just an incredible person. No finer person I will ever know, as I said, and Gordon Bradley is just an amazing human being who gave so much. Then as he was coach of the Washington Diplomats, the team that I supported, he coached, you know, Johan Cruyff in 1980. And so, you know, I was blessed with that. I had Clint Pied as a color analyst for one season, and that was a great perspective because he was one of the original DC United players, a testament to Thomas Rongen that he came back as a color analyst and is one of my closest friends to this day. And he came back as a color analyst after he was fired as head coach of DC United, but he was also a guy who, you know, look, coaches get fired, and that's what happens, and he understands that. And every coach has his shelf life, for lack of a better way of saying it. So, you know, Thomas Day is just, you know, I think an underappreciated commentator as he continues to do so much television, because along with the flair and the passion, you know, he brings obviously just immense knowledge. He's got that Dutch soccer mind. But you know, again, Santino Quaranta and my current partner Devin McTavish, they played the game. When you're dealing with, you know, guys that played the game at a high level, like they did, they offer wonderful insight and different personalities. And so, you know, there's not one that I say is favored over another. Garth Lagerwey was a partner of mine for a while. I'm leaving out John Harkes. Now, see, this is the problem. I'm trying to bring these off the top of my head. It's not been that many, really, when you think about it, over 25 years. I mean, John Harkes, he was ahead of his time in what he did for American soccer. I mean, think about going in. You know, now we talk about how many Americans are playing in Europe. In the 1990, they were laughing at the idea that an American was playing in Europe or in England, as John Harkes was. John Harkes scores the goal of the year while he's playing for Sheffield Wednesday. I was at
at Wembley Stadium in, just 4 years ago, right about this time for the playoffs. And I mentioned to some Sheffield Wednesday was involved in the playoffs, and I mentioned to some Sheffield Wednesday supporters I was friends for John Harkes. Well, I didn't have to buy anything, a drink or otherwise, the rest of the night, because this is 2016 now, but these supporters still think of John Harkes as this amazing club legend from when he played in the early 90s with Sheffield Wednesday. So, you know, it's a long way of saying that I've been, you know, you think about the pedigree of a John Harkes, you think about a Thomas Rongen, who was roommates with Johan Cruyff with the Washington Diplomats in 1980 and came up through the Ajax youth system, for goodness sakes, and Rinus Michels, one of the greatest managers of all time, he learned under. So these are guys that, you know, Gordon Bradley, who helped establish and make the NASL survive. So you've got that class, and then you've got, you know, as I said, the Santino Corantas, the Deb McTavish, Garth Lagerwey. These are American success stories that made it in the professional game. So then they bring their perspective. So you know, I'm very proud of what we've done in DC United Television. If you look at and obviously Clint PA as well, as you look at who we've had be with us on DC United Broadcast, it's been a great cast.
It really has. Out of all the games you've called, and, you know, I know you've called some brilliant games for DC United locally, but obviously there has to be maybe one or two games that you couldn't do because of the national television contracts through ESPN, through NBC Sports, Fox Sports. Which is the one game you wished you would have called between DC United and the Metros, even, of course, with the change to the New York Red Bulls in those rivalry games, or even any game, which one did you wish you could have called?
You know, that's a hard question. I mean, I think the classic New England playoff game of, I guess, 2004, I'm trying to remember offhand, that comes to mind. I mean, but, you know, again, you don't really think about it too much because you understand that's part and parcel of the way things exist or the structure. But, jumps out. I'm sure there are other games, it's been so many years that I forget certain. I think about the moments I was involved in, so I don't think as much. Not that I don't celebrate the moments I wasn't involved in. I don't want to make it sound like that. But I guess that New England playoff game, the Eastern Conference final, jumps to mind as one right off the top of my head.
How about this? And maybe I'll jog your memory. How about the Bob Bradley, or as they call it, the Cheatin' Bob incident with the fourth substitution that was supposed to be for goalkeepers only? What did you think about that one? Did you want to call that one?
Yeah. You know, you want to call everyone. I mean, the truth be told, it's actually one of the advantages of as I do NBA broadcast, I actually feel for my television counter local ones because, you know, they, because of network conflicts, they have to stop after the first round of the playoffs, and we get to continue. And I say get to continue is because it's not so much, you know, when you're actually calling a team, it is broadcasting, you're not more than that. You're just broadcasting and trying to convey the story to the listener or the viewer. But having said that, if you're with a specific team and you're calling so many games, you're with them the whole way. And you're at the training sessions two or three times a week and the games and the appearances with them. So you wish you could be with them for every game or to broadcast every game because that's how you spend 7 months, of a year with them. So, yeah, I don't know if I've given a lot of, you know, thought about, oh, man, I wish I could have done that. Yeah, you know, it's natural feelings, but, you know, you also know it wasn't it wasn't to be, and it's not the way it's ever been as the league has moved on. As on a local standpoint, we've done, originally in the early years of the league, we were involved more in the playoffs on a local standpoint, but in more recent years, it's not been the case. It's been few and far between that we've been involved, and you kind of just accept that.
What was your opinion about the whole Freddie Adu situation, how he was signed and how young he was? Did you feel this was the step forward the league had to make?
Well, I think it was not so much as it didn't turn out the way that we had all hoped, and Freddie had hoped as well. And knowing Freddie, and he's a really good guy, and I know he worked hard to try to that's a heavy mm-hmm. burden to carry, and when it doesn't work out. But I don't think I think you can only judge based on what was going on at the time. And there was other clubs from outside the United States that were interested in him. Certainly there were a lot of, forces around him, the marketing side of it, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not unheard of for a, 14-year-old to be, put in the situation, be it in music or tennis or whatever. Having said that, it's there's also a great history of people that are at that age put into pressure situations that doesn't end so well. So I do know that the club tried to, do as much as they could to help him through that period. And again, keep in mind, it's not like his career was a total bust. I mean, there's a guy that played and contributed for the national team and won an MLS Cup. He was a very talented player. It just didn't live up to, what we were led to believe. What we were kind of all expecting. And I just remember when working in D.C. at the time, a writer for the Washington Post, it was not a sports writer, coming up to me and saying, have you heard about this guy, Freddie Adu? And he was just, everybody was just, there was so much buzz and so much, talking about, boy, he is going to be, something else. And he was a good player. I mean, let's not make it out like, he got on the field and didn't, electrify people. And his, I still remember that period of time. He definitely did. If we went to other stadiums, other road cities, he brought in crowds. So, I think it was, I don't know if that's, if there'll be another Freddie Adu type situation where there probably will be, where there's, the next can't miss kid, but it didn't, pan out the way we all hope. But I don't think it does either Freddie or a lot of people trying to go back and criticize or look, hindsight's always 20/20. And I think, I know the people. I know, Peter Novak, who was the coach at the time. I know the other players that were on the team at the time. Everybody was working hard to look out for Freddie's best interest. And again, he had, he contributed to DC United's success, and he's welcomed back as by the fans. And when we came back for an alumni game. If you're going to grade it on, did he reach the hype? No, that didn't happen. But did he have some wonderful, wonderful moments and create some great memories? Yes, he did.
So for as long as I can remember, RFK Stadium was the home of DC United. RFK, of course, is, one of those old-fashioned donut stadiums. You can have both baseball and NFL football there. course, when DC United came around, it was shared between the Redskins and United. Then when the Redskins left for FedEx Field, the Nationals came over from Montreal. That was shared with baseball for a short period of time. Did you feel that, okay, you understood that there's no place else you can play for DC United? You had to share it with the Redskins, but were you upset when the Nationals were forced to share share RFK with DC? Did you feel, well, listen, this should be hours and hours alone? Did you ever have those feelings?
No, I mean, you know, you knew. Oddly enough, we actually only shared with the Redskins 1 year. 1996 was actually the Redskins' final year before they moved out to FedEx. So, because of that, it essentially, you know, for so many years with the really, you know, the thought of baseball coming to D.C. had been talked about, and, you know, they missed out on expansion in the early 90s. And it's one of these things where you thought would always be just a story and never really happened. And then all of a sudden it did. And I remember, obviously, covering that, you know, with on television and radio. And, but we knew it was not our stadium. It was not a soccer specific stadium. It was not DC United Stadium. We had had to, you know, adjust our schedule or have the field remade because of various rock concerts that were put in there. That's not the same as sharing with another team. But in other words, it wasn't our home. It was not our own stadium. And so when the Nationals came along, it at least for me personally, I just accepted it because Major League Baseball coming to D.C. was good for the city. And they needed RFK as a transition home. So but in the end, it also worked out for DC United, as they were, through the ownership group of Jason Levien and Eric Cohier, able to come to the table with the right deal to get Audi Field accomplished, which is an amazing situation because you literally have a soccer stadium just a couple blocks down from the baseball stadium, on one of the most prime pieces of real estate in the nation's capital, which when you look at where other teams had to build stadiums in Major League Soccer, it typically was not in that situation. And that is not to criticize other teams. It's very hard in any sport to get a stadium or arena deal done, because the minute you announce it, you're going to now then face opposition forces. It doesn't matter what the sport is. I've never seen or heard of a stadium that just, all right, we're going to build this and bam, you know, everybody says we're excited, let's build it. No, there usually is a bit of a debate, and that's, you know, which is not a bad thing. I mean, everybody needs to voice their opinion to make sure you're getting the right spot, but DC United certainly has got the right spot in Audi Field.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I have to ask you this. How are the sight lines for the broadcast booths at Audi Field? It has to be at least a different feel and a different view than it used to be at RFK for you and the millions of analysts you've worked with for all those games.
Well, it's Audi Field is, RFK was a great stadium, and that was part of why, you know, for so many years, it was almost like a second home for U.S. soccer as well. And but, I mean, you're just much closer to the action. And it may sound overly dramatic. I mean, it's not like it's at RFK we felt like we were a million miles away. That's not at all. Actually, again, very good sight lines. It was a tremendous facility. But the way, you know, the compactness of Audi Field, and as we sit in our booth at midfield, I mean, you really, you know, you feel like you're in on the action, which is also the way the spectators feel. It just, the field is right, the stands are right up on the field. So, you know, it makes for, I think, a great, obviously it's made for a great atmosphere the last, you know, almost 2 years that we've had it, not quite because of COVID, obviously shutting things down. But, you know, we started in July 14th of 2018 playing there, and it's, it's the place is rocked, and it's and to call games there has been an absolute joy.
No, it has. I mean, I've already been there three times, once last year, twice 2 years ago. Yeah, I don't need to drive anymore from New York. I just take the train down. I just take the train down from Newark Penn Station, get to Union Station, transfer for the Red Line DC Metro to Gallery Place, transfer at the Green Line to get the Navy Yard Ballpark, and just the distance walking-wise is just absolutely brilliant. What was it, or at the time, I guess, a sentimental feel for you that you weren't driving to RFK anymore, that you're driving to this other part of at the district because it's a brand new everything? Obviously, there's new places there, new shops, new living buildings. There's an area that you can get rest. There's a restaurant area, hotels. What did that feel like for you to go to an area where it is historic in its own right, but now you're going to a different part of the district where the neighborhood has really spruced up big time, not just because it's DC United and Audi Field, but of course for the Washington Nationals and Nationals Park.
Well, I mean, and let me just throw in a quick thing as you talk about coming down from New Jersey. We are spoiled in this country now with these soccer stadiums because, you know, Audi Field's got great sidelines. I brag all the time. Red Bull Arena is an incredible place, and I hope that, you know, people, as much as we're arch rivals, I hope that more and more people in the New Jersey area realize, in New York, New Jersey, what a gem they have. And if you're going to – I remember sitting – in the quote-unquote upper deck for the All-Star game in 2011, I think it was. And you know, you still felt like you're on top of the field. So that is just an amazing facility. And again, I hope that, you know, people, more and more people start to realize that. The funny thing about Audi Field, it wasn't so much getting used to driving to Audi Field. It was getting used to not driving to National Airport because, if you remember, in 2018, because, you know, Audi Field was not going to be ready until July of that season, and it's not unlike with Toronto or Sporting Kansas City or, well, maybe not Toronto, but Sporting Kansas City, or, well, I guess Toronto, yeah, when they did the renovations to their stadium, where, you know, the schedule is altered that you had so many road games at the beginning. So in 2018, the first 15 of 17 games we played were on the road. So I still remember almost starting to drive to National Airport for that first game. And it was just, and I caught myself and said, no, wait a minute. I'm going to Audi Field. And this is for the game against, you know, Vancouver, July 14th, when we opened Audi Field. I think I was able to make the emotional separation just because DC United did such a wonderful job in sending off RFK against New York the previous year, in October of 2017. You know, we just had a series of, you know, farewell events and a countdown and really it was sent off in the proper way. I mean, it wasn't just, all right, here's the game. I remember that final day started with a couple of alumni games, and then we even brought back players from the NASL Washington Diplomats, Roy Wilner and some others, and Kirk Kuykendall. Because, you know, RFK was given the proper send-off, by the time we got to Audi Field, you'd already emotionally said goodbye. It wasn't a hasty, quick goodbye. It was a long goodbye where we did celebrate the stadium, and we should have. Because, you know, that place, you know, created so many great memories for DC United, the franchise. And that's great to be able to talk about that. And now, you know, we go into a new place and it's a new journey. So initially it was just making sure I didn't drive to National Airport again.
You know, I have to say this. You know, you've had a very long broadcasting career, not just in soccer, also locally. As well as the NBA. I mean, let's be honest. I kind of similarities between you and Marv Albert, who's, of course, a staple in New York City broadcasting, sports broadcasting. I mean, you know, on television with the New York Knicks. At times, he was doing New York Rangers on the radio with WFAN. He was also doing the NFL on at the time, and NBC was doing the AFC games. Also, the NBA on NBC. He was also doing local 11 o'clock sports on the New York NBC affiliate. You of course, in my opinion, you run DC Sports Broadcasting, WRC. National NBC TV in Washington, WTOP, the sports program director. You're also the radio voice of the Washington Wizards, and you do DC United. And occasionally, you've done in the past when it was Fox Soccer Channel, a couple of games here and there. Where do you find the time to take a day off and spend the time with your family? It has to be a strategic thing to do, outside of what's going on now, of course, but. You know, you're all over the place in our nation's capital.
No, I've been very, I've been blessed. It's been a great, journey. Has been able to do a lot of different things, whether it was soccer or the Washington Wizards or obviously DC United, and as you mentioned, NBC4, which I still do some television anchoring, and WTOP, which I do the radio. But it's what I truly love. And yeah, it does stretch your time, but I've always tried to, when my son was playing sports, I never missed a game or, you would have some crazy things where you, you'd get off a plane at 4 a.m. and have to be at a hockey game at 7 a.m., but you didn't want to miss that for anything in the world. So it certainly, boredom has not been one of my problems, that's for sure. And so, but it's been, I've been blessed. This is what I've always wanted to do, and fortunately, may not be that I'm the most talented guy, but I'll work hard for whoever, and so they kept me working hard these last 30 years or so. So, and hopefully it continues. Still, even though we're not having games, we're still doing the WTOP every morning. And now we're doing different stories and looking forward to when games come back. But yeah, it's been a great journey. But soccer has been a such an important part of my life, and obviously DC United. But it goes back, before then, and which is why, I have such an emotional connection and wanting and hoping that everybody enjoys the passion that I enjoy for this wonderful game, and that. That our league that has come so far. I mean, again, it is mind blowing that, we're talking about 26 teams and more on the way, and stadiums, and it's a wonderful thing. But it only continues if we continue to, mm-hmm. Foster a good supporter culture, and I think we have a chance to do that because we are. It's not just the stadiums, but that's also part of it. I mean, if you're going to become a Red Bull fan, or if you're going to become an Inter Miami fan or a mm-hmm. United fan, you're going to go to a Philadelphia. I mean, that, as I've gone up there sometimes as just fans, as a fan, as those games you mentioned, we don't broadcast, that it's a great atmosphere to be a fan. And that's what's such an encouraging thing right now about Major League Soccer, because, and I say that, I mentioned the stadiums because, when I was doing games in the old APSL, we were playing in the Maryland Bay's home last couple of years was Cedar Lane Park, mm-hmm. which was this makeshift stadium that with wooden benches and that type of thing. So we've come a long way since then. I think it's important for supporters to appreciate that.
So where do you see yourself down the road? How much longer do you see yourself calling DC United games? Will you lighten your load, I guess, which I hope you don't. I really hope you don't. But, how much longer do you feel you'll have calling DC United games before, I guess, the next wave comes in, or maybe the next Maybe you'll have your own protege coming in and helping out. Maybe it'll be your son. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't think it's – he doesn't have any interest in broadcasting. But, I can't – I just enjoy each season. And that means Wizards or DC United or whatever. And you just hope that you're still connecting, with the fans and that's what keeps you going. And you hope that, there's a next season. So at this point, I don't have any, I'm not retiring. That's for sure. Or that type of thing. So it's just important as long as you feel like, you're connecting with the people you're broadcasting to broadcasting with. It's the fans. It's a connection. And I've been blessed. The DC United supporters over the years, I've been on this walk with them as we walked literally to try to get a stadium for DC back in the early 2000s so I think that the fans and supporters appreciate that I'm not just showing up to do a broadcast. This is my team that's been a big part of my life, and it means that much to me that I'm going to try to make sure I give it the best broadcast possible. So, as always, the fans and supporters will determine when it's time for you to go.
I'm going to go to the phone book. I'm going to go and look up Frisco, Texas, and I'm going to find the phone number for the Soccer Hall of Fame, because you need that red coat, sir. You need that red blazer. You're having a wonderful career. You've been absolutely fantastic, and you deserve to go in there as a living legend. That's my book. That's in my book, obviously.
Well that's very kind, and that hall is a special place. I still remember on a road trip with a couple of friends of mine, we were going up to Montreal in 1988, and I convinced them to stop by Oneonta to see the Soccer Hall of Fame, because at that point it was in Oneonta in New York, I thought we would actually spend the night there, thinking it would take us all day to go through the Soccer Hall of Fame, but the wonderful Oneonta is a great place, and again, Oneonta's the college history with Hardwick and et cetera is for a long time was had the heartbeat of our game in this country, and that's why the Hall of Fame was there. But we ended up just continuing in Montreal because it didn't take that long to go through the Hall of Fame at that time. But boy, there's so many players and other people's out there that also deserve to get in. That'd be a special thing if it ever happened. But I'm not worried about that. And I've had a wonderful career, and it's great that it has a home in Frisco, and it's great that it has a home, connected with one of Lamar Hunt's, basically his hometown of Dallas, Texas. Because again, in generations from now, we will hopefully always be talking about Lamar Hunt Open Cup and what he did for soccer in this country, because again, the storyline of why this amazing success story happens is a Lamar Hunt who believes in the game after the 66 World Cup, for goodness sakes, and he stays in it from 1967 on, period. It's a Lamar Hunt that discovers a Don Garber as a commissioner. As I mentioned, I had Gordon Bradley as my first broadcast partner. These are people that while we're getting further and further away from the 70s and 80s, that they're a big reason what they did and what they accomplished in kind of a Wild West environment where you didn't have a lot of support from anywhere. It really is what's given us the steel to now have what we do have, a successful, thriving league in Major League Soccer in this country.
Dave, thank you very much for your time. I always appreciate you coming on the show. Continued success with your career calling games, whether it be D.C. United, Washington Wizards, or just regular Washington, D.C. radio and television. Hope to see you again soon this season. Have a good night. Hope you and your family are safe and sound with this whole pandemic. And once again, thank you very much for your time.
Well, no, thank you for your time, and not just tonight. All the time is again, we don't have soccer continue as a success without someone who's working as hard as you to create that passionate environment, and not just one week, but every week. And that's what it's all about. It's one thing to do a one-off or a special here and there, but what I've always admired about you is just how committed you are to the excellence of covering the game of soccer, and that shows up in so many things you do, and so that's why every time you say would you like to come on, I'm deeply honored, and I thank you.
Thank you. Good night, sir. Take care, Dave.
Take care.
All right, that's Dave Johnson, the television play-by-play voice of D.C. United, and also the radio voice of the Washington Wizards, WTOP and WRC television NBC affiliate in Washington, D.C. Thank you for listening tonight. I hope everyone enjoyed listening to this interview as much as I enjoyed giving it. Once again, Dave Johnson, the TV play-by-play voice of D.C. United, 25 years in the business and keeping on going strong. My name's Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you for listening to me tonight. And as always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night. Talk to you next Monday. It will be formerly the television play-by-play voice of the Columbus Crew, Dwight Burgess. He called it a career after 25 years. I can't wait to have him on. Have a good night. Take care. So long. And bye-bye for now.